Welcome back to Happy Porch Radio, the digital agency podcast for progressive agency owners and web professionals. Season 4 is an exploration of diversity in our industry, especially gender diversity. This season, your host, Barry O'Kane, is joined by some wonderful co-hosts for conversations with agency leaders and diversity and inclusion experts.
Welcome back to Happy Porch Radio. In this episode, Erica and I speak to the amazing Molly Watt. Molly is registered deafblind due to a genetic condition called Usher syndrome, and she uses her passion and experiences to specialize in accessibility and usability in the world of design. Now, Molly's story, presentation, and videos are truly inspiring, and in this episode, we have a fascinating and wide-ranging conversation about inclusion and diversity. So let's meet Molly.
Hi, my name's Molly, and I am an accessibility and usability consultant. I have a genetic condition called Usher syndrome, which forms deafness and blindness. So I was born deaf and then later on found out I was going blind. So this is one of the main reasons really why I fell into accessibility and why I'm so passionate about inclusion and trying to sort of persuade lots of people in all industries to think similar to myself in terms of designing and, you know, just creating all-inclusive experiences for everybody.
Awesome. Thank you. And thank you so much for joining us on the show. And also, as we know, we're doing, I have a co-host with me for every episode, and Erica's joining us this way. Hi, Erica.
Hello. How are you?
Yeah, really good. Thanks. So I reckon we should just jump in, Molly. And I have seen you present and read some of your stuff, and you do a really good job of summarizing your own background. And as you've done there, why that has sort of led you down to being so passionate and being so involved in accessibility and assistive technology and so on. But maybe that's a good place to start, if you just wouldn't mind sharing a little bit more of that backstory and what led you to where you are now.
Sure. Yeah. So as I just mentioned, I have this condition called Usher syndrome. But one of the early challenges, I think, was really the adjustment in living from being born as a deaf person, accessed in the world through my eyes and through hearing aid, and then losing my sight and figuring out how to actually access the world around me without having my vision. And that's when really I talk a lot about how privileged I feel to live in a day where we actually have access to bits of technology that can actually help me on my day-to-day life. So for instance, I use bits of mainstream tech and I have used all of it in every aspect of my life. So in terms of GCSE, so when I was doing my exams when I was 15, I could not have gotten through it without a Kindle or an iPad because I could not access the textbooks or anything like that. So all the material I have to modify myself using technology, otherwise I would not have been able to succeed in education. And so in the midst of all that was really trying to adjust to kind of the technical strategies, as well as also trying to accept that society hadn't quite gotten up to speed with kind of, I would say, diversity at that point, because I had a constant battle of trying to prove to people that I was actually capable of doing these things and that I was only capable unless I had the right tools and support. So one of the things about having Usher syndrome, albeit I was born deaf and I knew everything there was about being deaf, going blind was a whole new story because it was progressive and I lost a lot of my sight in 2 years. So I'd registered blind by the age of 14 and I was given my first guide dog at the age of 16. So a lot of things changed really quickly. And I'd probably say that one of the hardest part was actually accepting that, yes, I was a bit different and I could access things differently, but the people around me weren't all fully understanding of that. Teachers, for instance, they kind of didn't want to believe that I had this condition. Oh, but you look okay, so you must be fine. So I often found myself constantly trying to explain that actually I'm only so capable because I have the tools. I have bits of technology that allows me to communicate and be as independent as I am. So it's really through a series of experiences, being deafblind, but also with the tools that I've been able to have, I've really learned more about myself and how to really shout about what is needed and actually how we could try and get society more understanding and actually changing the way we think about accessibility. Because whilst a lot of companies talk about accessibility, which is great, I think they address it too much being that it's for minority groups, and actually it could be addressed as a majority kind of training so that people could actually be thinking more inclusively. And I guess I'm really passionate about that because I've experienced exclusion. I've experienced what it's like not to be able to access test papers in schools, and I've experienced not being able to access, you know, being part of a group, a friendship group. And it all can be tied together nicely with the right thinking, right tools, and the right support system. And I think that's really, yeah, why I kind of, after I withdrew from university, unfortunately, I withdrew again for some of the reasons that I spoke about, ignorance. You know, I had lecturers saying to me, you know, well, how are you going to be able to do this if you can't see or hear properly? And I think I was at a point in my life where I really thought, you know what, is this really what I want to do? Is this a battle that I want to fight? And I was defeated. I did feel quite defeated. But in hindsight, I think what life was trying to tell me was that I needed to do greater, bigger things. Like the degree that I was doing was to be a teacher, a primary school teacher, because I liked the idea of educating the next generation on inclusion. And, you know, well, if your teacher is deafblind, you can do anything, you know. But I think I felt that leaving university meant that I would go on to educate larger audiences. So I kind of do my public speaking, and I motivate people, and I talk about accessibility, inclusion, my life story, what I have led to doing what I do, how I've gained the confidence to be able to do so. And then, of course, I've started consulting in accessibility, usability, and inclusive thinking in all different kinds of industries. So whether it be kind of holiday making websites or kind of within recruitment. So I've had people talking to me about how can we actually employ people with disabilities, and what things do we need to be thinking, etc., etc. So I find myself kind of advising people a lot now, and I've started doing workshops as well. And the workshops are more about assistive technology and how we can make everything more compatible with assistive technologies and have a better understanding of how they work. Because I think a lot of people in the digital field feel that to put it bluntly, people think that if you have got assistive technology, then designers don't really need to do much more to make their website more accessible, which is just shocking. So really, I just work hard to try and change people's perspectives on not only accessibility, but leading into being more diverse and thinking more inclusively to meet the needs of every end user, not just minority groups. And I do that by using my own experiences, user testing, talking to people, and networking.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you. That's, I mean, both inspirational, but also really, I mean, there's so much in there that we could dig into. There's one thing that really sort of jumped out at me that you said a couple of times, in that you're talking about not just minority, but majority. Can you sort of expand on what you mean by that a bit more?
I talk a lot about the aging population. So with that, what I mean is our aging population is growing, which is great. So we're all living longer. However, the only thing that would change is the way you access the world around you. So I talk a lot about my granddad, my dear granddad, who I love dearly and would probably hate to hear that I talk about him so much in my work. But we recently bought him, well, I say recently, a couple of years ago. I'm not sure if I spoke about it in the presentation that you saw me at, where I do talk about it quite a bit. We bought him an iPad a couple of years ago, and he was a total technophobe. He was like, nope, don't want this, don't need it, et cetera, et cetera. But he looked at it, and I found myself setting up this iPad exactly how I set up my products. Now, I am a registered deafblind person, and my granddad is just an elderly old man who's got very thick lenses. He needs hearing aids. His mobility is restricted now. He's a lot slower. And it's just simple things in his day-to-day life that he could now do on his iPad. And it wasn't hard. It was the usability of it that made it so easy for him to be able to just do things with a tip of a finger. And I use that example because I'm deafblind, but the way I use the product is very similar to my 80-year-old granddad, and he is just an older man. So we talk a lot about the acquiring disabilities, temporary disabilities. So for instance, if you break an arm, how do you behave with your product using one hand? How can we make that easier? Or if you simply have one arm. So the similarities between temporary and acquiring disabilities, as well as, you know, having disabilities, there are lots of similarities there. So I often, what I do is I get people to think about where they are going to be in 30 plus years time. Will they still be able to drive? Will they be able to run? You know, they may well have a walking stick, or they may well need reading glasses. That's a common one I talk about. One in four people need reading glasses by the time they get to the age of 40, which therefore means they are wearing assistive technology, and so they have accessibility needs. So why doesn't everything come in large print now? Or why don't you get a version that is large print should you need it? Like menus, they're always tiny. Why are they tiny? You know, it's just simple things like that. And I sort of think, actually, if we think that having large print not only benefits me as a blind person, it benefits a lot more people that need glasses that might turn up to the office and forget their glasses. My granddad, I've been out for dinner with him, he's forgotten his glasses, and I have had to read the menu to him because I can access it more than him. And that is because people have this shallow understanding of what accessibility means and what being blind means. For example, people think that if you are blind, you see nothing at all, and you use auditory tech like voiceover and things like that. But I am not an auditory tech user. I use large print, and that's exactly the same as lots of people. Like my parents, they use their emails with large print. And I just sort of think that's actually more of a universal tool. Like lots of people would benefit from that, like Pinch Zoom and things like that. Everyone uses it. Why can't it be seen as more of a mainstream feature opposed to accessibility? So that I try and link it all up to the aging population. Where are you going to be in several years' time? You will still be working, you'll still be doing this because we are all more than capable of doing so. But the way you interact with the world around you will change, because that's life. Everyone ages. I just got there first, you know. So that's what I mean when I talk about that.
I find that really interesting because, I mean, coming from the, as working on teams or working with people, and we're creating products or websites or digital products, and I think you talk about this as well, like quite often the first thing is just to get the priorities clear, how important, you know, it is important to think about these things, which is why I picked on that sort of seeing, you know, the accessibility, for example, on a website as a, you know, it's just a minority, there's just a few people, you know, it's a kind of, and that directly correlating to the time and budget and priorities that we put on those sorts of thinking. So I think that's really interesting when you're sort of talking about saying, well, it's not a minority, or it's not sensible to think about it as a minority, but there's this broader thing. And even that example you said, like of a broken arm or a temporary issue on top of, you know, it just kind of changes that mindset a bit. I think that's really interesting.
I think it is certainly a case of perspective and training, because especially where accessibility is concerned, I know everything comes back to budgets, et cetera, but if you're going to include accessibility, you've got to make it accessible, because when this is the problem I have with the checklist that we have, vision, hearing, motor and cognitive. Now, we just focus on vision, for example, and what people think is they tick as they go along. Right, my website is compatible with screen readers, so therefore my website is fully accessible to the blind. Totally incorrect, because out of the blind community itself, there's only a very small percentage, between 3-5% of blind people that see nothing at all. And all the rest of them have got vision and they want to use it. So if they can utilize it by having larger text or changing the colors, things like that, you're meeting so many more people. Whereas it's like people have this mindset that accessibility is just this tiny little percentage and it's almost not worth addressing it, you know. And it's kind of like, well, no, if you're going to do it, you need to meet the needs of everyone. And actually, whilst you do that, you realize that you are helping more people than you realize, because it's not necessarily the likes of people like myself, but it's likes of people like my granddad, who just has a really strong prescription or people that, you know, wear glasses, or people that have blurred vision due to medication or something. You know, there's always something that could happen that could impair vision, and it's more common than people realize. So it is a matter of perspective and prioritizing, like you say, because if you prioritize that actually you want the user experience to be great for everybody, well, you need to put more money into accessibility, because if they can access it, you're gonna have more clients. It's just more customers. That's just how it works. So yeah, it is a matter of awareness, I think, ultimately. A lot of people don't realize that about the blind community, how few people actually see nothing. And that's just one example, you know, out of all of the components.
Just to step back a little bit, so this season of the podcast is our sort of broad topic is diversity. And the reason I'm really interested in this topic and talking to you, Molly, is I guess where I'm coming from is the hypothesis that diverse teams, or having more diversity and understanding within the teams that are working on products, mean that they'll be stronger and more aware of things like accessibility and the inclusiveness stuff. So I guess I just want to put that out there as a question mark to you or something. Is that a fair statement? And how closely related are this sort of the challenge of prioritizing and doing accessibility and inclusiveness and when we're building products and thinking about the diversities of the team doing that work?
Yeah, I think that is a really important factor, because by having a more diverse team, you're bringing in a diverse amount of perspectives and experiences. Because I think it's not just about, if you take user testing, for example, it's not just about getting a group of blind and deaf and disabled people in to test your product to see how accessible it is. It's actually about getting a group of people, all diverse, for whatever reason, whether it be a disability or something else, and getting them to test it. Because I often see sometimes accessibility more as a preference. So when we think of it as preferences, it seems more mainstream and everyone has a preference. Because of course, I would prefer to have my website more accessible, but then the next person might prefer to have more of a higher contrast for whatever reason. They prefer darker backgrounds or whatever. You know, some people just like the color black. And I think by bringing in more, having more input from a diverse team would definitely bring more ideas to the table. What one person thinks, the other person won't think. And what I'm saying to you guys, you might not have heard before, and vice versa. So it's all about learning from everyone's experiences, whoever they are, whether they have a disability or not. And I think, I mean, I used to work at Apple in retail, and one of the things that I loved about working there was that it was very diverse, and they were just very open-minded with people. So they took on lots of people. I don't think they went out thinking, right, we're going to employ diverse groups. I think they were just open-minded, and it was like that from the very beginning, whereas lots of people are kind of backtracking from that. They're like, right, now we need to think about diversifying our team and let's bring in some blind people and some, you know, whereas Apple were great in that they started off being open-minded and they've just let people in. And I think that might just be one of the reasons why they're pretty successful, because they had that mindset. And I think it works both ways, because in terms of being accessible and inclusive, you need to be aware of the diversities out there. And, you know, and I think people that are from diverse backgrounds are going to think more inclusively, because they have been brought up to be diverse and to be maybe different in a crowd, and they're like, actually no, we're proud to be different and we want to endorse that. So I think it's really important to have diversity everywhere. I think it's really important for everybody to learn more from other cultures, disabilities, you know, religions, etc. And I think the only way we can do that by going forward is learning from each other, rather than taking orders from people and training and this, that and the other. It's actually working with each other and just getting out there, getting more people in as well, and just from all different kinds of backgrounds. And I'm not just talking about being disabled. I mean every background, because there's so many things that people just don't realise. And it's like if we're talking about me and my condition, people say to me, oh, I would never have known had I not have met you. And I'm just like, it's exactly that, because until you've met someone that's talking about it, you're not aware of it. So it's literally that. And I think it applies to everybody, whoever they are, whatever their experience is. So I think it's just down to society kind of allowing people to feel that they can also have diverse views and allow more diversity in. It's a work in progress for sure. I think a lot of people shout about diversity, which is amazing, but actually going through with it, I think we still have a bit of work to do with that.
So that's really interesting. And as you're saying that diversity, and there was something you said there that really, and now I would love to have memorized the words you used, but saying that basically, if I paraphrase, that a diverse team is kind of a prerequisite for approaching these problems in a different way, rather than coming afterwards and saying, oh, we want now to make our thing accessible, or we want to make our team diverse, and trying to sort of patch it on afterwards. And that if you start with a team that's more open and more diverse, then you're more likely to have more impactful or positive products from the start. I guess if I'm sort of paraphrasing slightly there.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's like we always say, accessibility is not an afterthought. It cannot be. You cannot design a website and then bring accessibility in. It just doesn't work. You know, it has to be. I know lots of people do it that way, you know, but often you find they spend more money doing that because they have to reverse a lot of what they've already done. So it is kind of about creating that base to begin with and having, yeah, just being fully educated. I mean, obviously no one's going to be perfect. No one's going to get it right first time. That's the other thing. We have to acknowledge that no one is perfect. Like, even I'm still learning in the field of accessibility. There are things that I don't know, you know, but I think because I was brought up with this disability, and I think lots of people would say the same with disability, you are a lot more open-minded because you've been through exclusion. You've been put in a room where you felt kind of like you weren't understood. And so when you're put in a room with someone else that might be feeling that way, that person, I myself would be more understanding of that person feeling that way, because, oh, I understand because I went through that. You know, you have more empathy, that's a word I'm going for. And I think that's really important. And that's why I started doing the workshop, to try and get people not only to listen to me, but actually generate some kind of understanding and empathy to kind of put that into their current work, whatever that is. You know, it's like, okay, yeah, I can see how that would change the way they feel when they're at work. How can we change that? Just little things like that. Because that person, until they've been with someone, like I just mentioned, until they've met someone with the challenges, they don't know. So it is very much about thinking about it right from the beginning, and, you know, just letting everybody voice their opinion, really, before kind of moving forward with the project or whatever, kind of getting people in and listening to them, really.
So is that something you find, that sort of educational, the why it's important is almost, you know, and then getting into the how we actually make things accessible. Like you said before, you know, there's endless checklists and there's things we can do, and there's like, it's not like a job that's done once, but it's a kind of ongoing thing where you need to sort of be thinking about accessibility as you're working on the product. So that's the how. But what you're talking about there is very much, you know, even before starting on the how, we need to kind of educate and make people make the decision that they're going to do that. Do you think that, I mean, when you talk about that education, and when people bring you in, is it that part of the equation that a lot more of the energy and effort goes into? Or is there, by the time they've maybe decided to talk to you or somebody else, that they're actually past that and that they're starting to, okay, well, how do I do this?
I think that's one of the main issues I have with what I do is, for A, getting into a company and getting them to listen to me. That bit is actually the easier part, because I can easily kind of sell why I need to be in and why they need me. But B, actually paying for it. So obviously I can't just live off fresh air. You know, so I am a consultant and I do presentations, right? But consulting and things like that is quite hard. And that's when I start to understand what company's priorities are, because you sort of think, well, actually, you talk about budgeting, you talk about this, you want to know how to do it, you want to learn more, which is great, that's why you're contacting me, but you don't want to pay for it. And so often that's the hardest part for me, to actually even get through the door, to actually talk to people and educate them and help them with the how we go forward, etc., with the workshop and some of the things that I do. I think that is the hardest part. I think once I've actually gone in and I've spoken to them, we've done the workshops and, you know, worked with the team, they are definitely more aware of how they can actually go ahead with, you know, whether it be further training amongst the staff or whether it a whole remodel of the website. Or but the thing is, often I'm saying it's not even worth that. It's literally just little things that can make a massive difference. But that, I would say, is more my challenge, is actually getting in to tell them how, because a lot of them don't, they sort of think, oh, actually, is it worth that? And that's my challenge there, is actually to weigh out, try and sell it to them, actually, yeah, it really is worth it. Because if you have a product or a website that is, you know, you think is going to be really worthwhile, in order to reach every user, you need to be fully accessible, usable, you need to be inclusive. In order, and what recruitment I find really interesting, because they're always like, we want to attract diverse groups, da, 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 da. And it's like, well, you're not going to if you haven't built an all-inclusive accessible website. It's just not going to happen. LinkedIn, classic example, totally inaccessible. I'm only on it and I will just copy and paste what I put on my Facebook and my Twitter and all of that. Obviously I'm on it because if I can get work from it, great. But if I get a message from them, from someone, I automatically have to reply saying, hi there, really sorry, can't access LinkedIn, can you please email me at da, 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 because I can't access it. But then lots of other people like myself would just be, they just want to have that opportunity to be on LinkedIn, to network with other business owners or get work, etc. They would have to seek help elsewhere, which is, as we all know, quite hard if you're not disabled, let alone disabled. So yeah, I just think that it's just really key that people are aware of the importance, and once they know how important it is, the how part actually isn't so tough, because it, there's people like myself out there that can go in and definitely help with that. I think it's just getting them to realize how important it is that is the main challenge.
I wonder, it makes me think, in the design industry, I have a hard time selling certain services as well, namely planning. I don't know why anybody wouldn't want to plan their site, but anyway, different story. But I'm wondering if this is an opportunity for people in the tech industry, such as Barry and I, and we're on the consulting side as well, and we think accessibility is really important, but we might not know how to sell it to the clients either to make them understand. So if there's some kind of like way that's, I don't know, just to form partnerships. Because I don't know where to start with accessibility either, because I don't have to deal with those issues like some other people have. So I don't know, it seems like a unique opportunity to help, you know, the people who are interested in helping make their clients aware. It'd be an interesting way to look at forming up some partnerships to help further disseminate that information, I guess.
Yeah, right, definitely. Yeah. I mean, it's like you say, it's just, it's kind of helping each other, really trying to get other people to understand why it's so important, because unless you're kind right. of on the wavelength, people just don't understand. It's like, oh, it's just an extra, it's not a priority in our budget, blah, blah, blah. That's all I hear, budget, budget, budget. And it's like, right. but you realize what this is going to do. Yeah, I'd be more than happy to look at that.
It's a really interesting thing you mentioned about LinkedIn, which is something that I was completely unaware of. Because now thinking and talking about recruitment and making those kind of connections that Erica just mentioned there, but then and not realizing that the tools themselves are almost blocking, you know, they're almost causing or contributing to the problem. That's really interesting to me. And to tie it back to what you and Erica were just saying about that, you know, explaining the value of why that, you know, if I'm trying to recruit a more diverse team and I'm using LinkedIn, but the people who I'm trying to recruit can't use LinkedIn and I'm not aware, you know, there's such an obvious gap in knowledge there. It's just mind blowing.
Yeah. It is mind blowing. But people don't actually, I actually went to LinkedIn, right? I was invited to go to their LinkedIn head office last year in San Francisco. It's a great, love it there. Any excuse to go over there. But no, I was invited over there. One of the interesting things that I learned there was the head of accessibility who invited me, who I later found out was actually fully blind. So totally blind, got no vision. So he relies on VoiceOver, which is on all iPhones, iOS products. And I sat in a room, there's probably about 8 or 9 of them. And the guy that was kind of above the guy that I was dealing with was on Skype on the wall. And then like all these people, it was really like cool. And I sat there and I showed them some of the features that I use. So I use large text and speak screen. Do you guys know speak screen?
I've seen the name, but that's about it.
So the difference between voiceover and speak screen is voiceover is more navigational. So for someone who is totally blind to feel their screen and listen to what is underneath their screen fingers, and then there's a couple of gestures like left, right. So if they want to flick to the next word or sentence, say it flick to the right, and then if they want to tap, double tap. So it's very confusing for sighted people to navigate it. For blind people, it's great because you don't need to use a screen. You don't need to see the screen whatsoever. You're just using a select amount of gestures to navigate your way through whatever. Now, I know how to use it when I show people in the workshops, and a lot of people aren't aware of how it's used, hence why they design really poor accessible products. But Jennison, who I saw, sort of said, you know, LinkedIn, voiceover is really great for LinkedIn. And I was like, okay. Now, the only reason he felt it was accessible was, bearing in mind he works at LinkedIn, I said to him, I used all the features I used, and then I tried voiceover before I went in. And I said, the thing is with voiceover on LinkedIn is that you have to be aware that the bar along the bottom where it says home, newsfeed, messages, whatever, you have to be aware where that is in order to put your finger across it. And he was like, oh yeah, but most people know where that is. No, actually, not everyone knows that, especially if you're using voiceover and you're totally blind, you're trying to navigate an app you've never navigated before. Jennison, who is fully blind and uses voiceover, knows where that is, so knows where to feel in order to access home, messages, etc. Now, the one that I use, Speak Screen, is actually a feature on iOS designed for people with dyslexia. So you literally just swipe two fingers down from the top of the screen and it reads top to bottom the text. So it doesn't tell you the orientation of the screen, the time, or anything like that, because that's what voiceover would do. Voiceover would do everything. So I sat in that room showing them, and I said, right, speak screen, you know, swipe down, and it literally said no speakable content is available on the screen. And I was like, and they were all just like just silent. And I was like, so this is actually a tool that I use that visually impaired and dyslexic, and dyslexia is very common.
It's very big.
Yeah. And LinkedIn is not accessible. And so they were quite shut down by that. So again, that was because people assumed that if you were blind, you use voiceover. But I said, I am registered blind and have been for over 10 years now. And I've never felt the need to rely on voiceover. I use large text, speak screen as and when I need to if my eyes are tired, because I can see enough to navigate around the screen using Zoom. But I don't need voiceover navigational stuff because it's really chatty, and I'm also deaf, so I wouldn't get all of it because it's all very like auditory. So they were like, wow, like hadn't thought of that. But have they invited me back for training? And have they done anything since? No, they're not even compatible with, I don't know if you know, when you go into settings and you change your text to large text, underneath it says if that app is compatible with dynamic type, the app will automatically adjust its font size so it goes bigger. Now Twitter do it, and it's great. I go on, hence why I'm always on Twitter. It automatically enlarges and I can read the text and don't even have to make any adjustment to the app, because the app has just recognized that my phone is set to large text, so it automatically changes, which makes sense, right? Now all of them do it now. Facebook do it, Twitter do it. Oh, I say all of them, most of the networking site, but LinkedIn don't do it. And that is just so prehistoric now. And I keep telling them, why haven't you done that? Like large text, that's something that lots of people would benefit from, because I find it so tiny. And my dad does, and he uses it, and he's financial advisor. He loves LinkedIn, but he struggles because it's so tiny. And yeah, but that's just LinkedIn. That's just, but they think ironically, because they have a blind person in the team, they're doing their bit for accessibility. So
it's interesting that you say that they do have someone with a disability on their team. And so they are very tunnel focused, I guess, on that one disability.
Insightful. Very insightful.
Yeah. 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 So for people who maybe don't have that diversity on their team, even for that one person, like how can you, I don't even know what I'm asking, but like, how do you know that you're covering all your bases, right? Because LinkedIn obviously thinks that they've done a great job because they have this person who's blind on their team, but clearly they've missed the boat on some big areas. And then there's teams without diversity at all, with no disabilities or no, you know, whatever the case may be. And it is an ignorance thing. And I understand that, but it's just like, it's knowing where to start and how do you know if you've covered all your bases. And
that, I think that's what a lot of people stress about. And this is where I kind of become really nice and reassuring, is that you have to start somewhere, and you're never gonna meet everyone's needs. That's the thing. I think you just have to be very open-minded. I think you need to keep the communication going with lots of people. So for instance, if you do user testing, kind of keep that ongoing. I think kind of like do that every now and then, like bring people in and different people each time, and kind of keep the conversation going. And I think that's all you can do, because no one's ever going to please everyone. And that's the one thing I sort of say, like, although I can bang on about how crap LinkedIn is, but they're never going to possibly please everybody. But I think what's frustrating about LinkedIn, for example, is that people have said, I physically went to their office and told them what needed to be done, and they didn't do it.
They haven't done it. Yeah.
It's a mindset. So obviously what you're saying, obviously, how can we cover our bases? But start somewhere. And, you know, once you've started, it's all you can do. I think it's just having the right mindset and perspective and goal, if you like, to meet more needs of everybody. And that's all that can really be expected, really. That's how everything starts, doesn't it? You just have to start somewhere and hope that you're going to achieve something.
So kind of what I'm hearing there is that, you know, that quite, and I think this happens to me as well sometimes, like the feeling that the mountain is so big to climb that it's not even worth starting. But really what you're saying is that, you know, that's obviously self-defeating, and it's better to do something and realize that it's just, you know, it's never going to be perfect, but that is an ongoing journey in that direction, and that journey is important in itself, important enough to go on rather than sort of saying, I can't do it, so I'm not going to do anything.
Definitely.
Sometimes when when any of us go to a client or go to a project and say, okay, look, it's really important that we do something about accessibility here. And they don't listen, or they don't prioritize it, and it's just like slides under. But then in other circumstances, and maybe you've seen when they brought you in, they are really actively, proactively trying to move, you know, make things more accessible. And I'm wondering if you have any examples of what the difference there is. Is there something you can point to and say, you know, this type of situation or this type of client or this type of conversation leads to a more positive action, and then in other circumstances, they don't do it?
I guess other than what I've already told you, I think I've had a mixture of experiences. Yeah, I think it's been mainly when once I've been in and spoken to people or spoken from other people's experiences, it is more often than not kind of like a positive outcome. Like people are like, mm-hmm. Okay, you know, you can see why it's important, blah, 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 blah. I think, again, sometimes what I find when I'm invited to do a presentation opposed to consulting, I'll go in and I'm asked to kind of talk about myself and why it's important to design for accessibility and inclusion. And I find that I go in and they enjoy the presentation, I get lots of great feedback, but I talk a lot about, you know, training and going forward and doing workshops and consulting and how can we make this better experience for everybody. Sometimes what I find, I kind of go in and do the presentation and I'll sort of say, you know, please do be in touch if you want me to come back. And, you know, sometimes I just don't hear, and I sort of think, did you not get the memo? Like, I can't just come in and, you know, talk to you for half an hour and you be fully like in the know now. It just doesn't work like that. I think again, going back to the priorities, I think it's actually being committed to it. And I would say I would class a lot of some companies more committed than others, because some will have me in, sit and listen to me talk and say, yeah, that's great, you've got, you know, understand the importance, but then they kind of don't show anything for it. And that's happened a few times, I think. So again, kind of going back to what I've already said, really trying to kind of sell that point and actually also say that it's not an instant fix. You've got to work on it. Yeah, it takes time, and, you know, you've got to pay for it. I'm not about to, you know, volunteer myself to go in with my time. And, you know, I think it's just, it's tricky.
Yeah. And then tying that back to, as you to what we were talking about earlier, tying back the reason, you know, it's not just accessibility for its own sake, but like that it will bring these other benefits down the line. Cool. Awesome. Thank you so much, Molly. We're sort of heading towards running out of time, but I really appreciate that. But just to finish up, what would be good if you share some of the links and some of the where people can find connect with you and find out about what you do?
Yeah, sure. That's great. Yeah, no, I can send all that over. So just like my Twitter handle and things like that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll put them in the show notes there. Yeah. And it's Molly. So you, and also, by the way, we should mention the charitable trust that you do. Maybe just quickly mention that.
Yeah. So the Molly Watt Trust is a family-built charity that was set up back in 2011. And that was really through all the troubles I had in education. We didn't have a lot of help. And I think we wanted to try and set up a support system for those with Usher syndrome, because it's a lot more common than people realize. And we also identified that there were a few solutions, again, with my experiences, like what I mentioned before, with using a Kindle and an iPad. That was how I could access my education. So at the Molly Watt Trust, we fund bits of technology to help the everyday lives of those people living with Usher syndrome, because we don't sit and hope for a cure. You know, other charities do that, but we kind of live in the here and now. How can we make life easier? We know people with Usher syndrome are fully capable of going out there and succeeding. How can we help that? So we funded Apple Watches, Kindles, eyewear, all sorts of things. And we kind of bring people together as well, because some people with Usher haven't met other people with Usher syndrome. We meet their families, and we're just there, we mentor, and we just like to be there for people with Usher syndrome through all the struggles. And yeah, so that's Molly Watt Trust, and we can be found online also at mollywatttrust.com, and my personal website is mollywatt.com. so there's lots of blogs that go online. We like blogs. I write a lot, and we get lots of people with Usher syndrome to write a lot as well, kind of talking about technology or experiences in general, and kind of, yeah, just endorse experiences where we can, so the good and the bad experiences, so people can be more aware and going forward. But yeah, that's Molly Watt Trust.
Awesome. Thank you. That's really, really inspirational. I really like it. As I mentioned, we'll put those links in the show notes. People can check it out and find out more about you there. Thanks again. Thanks, Molly. Thanks, Erica.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You can get all the links and notes from this episode on happyporchradio.com, where you can also find out how to send us questions, feedback, and get involved in the conversation about this series. If you enjoyed the show, please share with anyone else who might enjoy it too. Thanks for listening.